which was the average of the first and second field, is quite a bit lower than from 2005, where it was 27, now 12.8. But in the bottom graph, you can see also we were catching wasps about in the same area. This is field two for 2006. Again, you can see that flattening effect at day one, and this was the same thing that we saw at day 10. We weren't catching wasps at this time, so our model tends to flatten out. Also, you'll see a peak around day three, which we'll look at again on our chart. These are our results for the parasitism. Similar results you saw, again, as with our sticky card captures, about the same meter distance where we were catching wasps. Here's a summary of our results again. And sort of like how we had in 2005, around that 3-4 day period is when we were finding we had the most wasps out in the field, with reduced numbers again, 1,000, 5,000, so reduced numbers that we had in 2006 compared with 2005. For the Kramer-von Mises test, which looked at the spatial correlation between our sticky card captures and our egg parasitism, we found that there was no significant difference in the distribution of these, which means that there was no effect of the traps on parasitism. So I want to talk a little bit about comparing our 2005 results to our 2006 results. Since in 2006 we did find a reduction in our dispersal, we believe that this decrease in dispersal in 2006 could be due to a number of factors. One being maybe the inclement weather. We had a lot more rainstorms in 2006, which tends to wet the sticky cards and not as many things stick to them. And also, egg masses tend to come unglued and fall off or get saturated. We also saw a reduced emergence of trichogramma in our release cartons that we used. We actually had just less numbers that were probably in the field. Also, our plot design changed. In 2006, we had just 4 points, which is the bottom thing there. We had 4 points around the furthest distance of the field, whereas in 2005, we had more monitoring points at that larger distance. So the conclusions for these studies, when we look at the average X98 value for all fields for both years, we found that it was approximately 17 meters. If we use this as a radius for dispersal in our field, it's about 0.1 hectares. When we want to look at this in conjunction with ECB suppression, along with our dispersal study, it tells us that we need to have multiple releases in a 0.4 hectare or 1 acre area for uniform coverage of the wasp throughout the field. Also, we saw that our highest numbers of catches were at the 3 and 4 day of our post-release. Kind of merging those two together, we can tell that the timing of our releases might have to be staggered to ensure that we have wasps during the time when we have the most European corn borers in our field. And also, by staggering these in distance, also we can have that uniform coverage of the wasps. That's all, and I'll take any questions that you have.
Okay, well, welcome to the Corn Rootworm Genetics Symposium. And I want to just give you a few introductory remarks. For those of you who don't know, there's a Diabrotica Genetics Consortium that was organized a few years ago now. And it's made up of institutions and scientists in these institutions who work with any aspect of genetics of Diabrotica. And so that includes phylogeography, population genetics, linkage mapping, resistance, and anything else you can think of, including those who don't actually work in genetics but are interested in what is happening in that field. The idea of the consortium is to facilitate communication between the members to reduce duplication and also to increase collaboration. And it's had those effects. We had a meeting, many of you were there, in Kansas City 3 years ago in December. And a lot has happened since then, so this is a good opportunity to get ourselves back up to date on what each other is doing. It's an international consortium. You'll see there's U.S. universities as well as federal, EPA, the molecular ecology branch is involved, Illinois Natural History Survey, and as well as other countries, including Canada, Germany, Switzerland, and France. Guess what? This isn't my talk. So I'm going to have to wing it. This was the original version that I submitted like a week ago, and I made many changes since then. So you'll have to bear with me. Okay, so the expected outcomes, we're looking for markers for resistant variants, isolating genes involved in resistance, looking at dispersal gene flow, phylogenetic relationships, and so forth. The long term is the sustainability of novel control strategies, increased profitability of farmers, reducing insecticide input, and others. Okay, so I'm going to...
What I'll be talking about today is the conservation value of a tool that's more commonly recognized for its research and its education value. This tool is citizen science, and what I hope to do in my presentation is explain why I consider citizen science a way to create, like May said, a research army for conservation. And before I start, I'd like to acknowledge the contributions of a longtime colleague of mine, Michelle Prisby, who was my graduate student many years ago and is now my colleague. She works for the Virginia Master Naturalist Program. And she and I developed the program together that I'll talk about today, and we continue to work together on it. So I'd like to just start by defining citizen science. We hear a lot about citizen science right now, and I think it's good to think of this as a tool. And it's a tool that's different from many tools. Many tools have a specific use.
Thank you very much, everybody. It's great to be here talking about one of my favorite topics. I don't get to speak about this very, very often. So these pictures here on this slide, I think are kind of emblematic of really what's going on in the world today in terms of global change. The picture on the left is the Muir Glacier in Alaska in the 40s, and the picture on the right is exactly the same spot in August of 2004. So you can see, for example, that this hill right here is exactly the same as that hill right there. There was a glacier here at one point, and now there's not. There's in fact a new landform called the Muir Inlet, which didn't used to exist because there was a glacier sitting in it. But from our perspective today, I want you to more focus on kind of right here, for example, which used to be rock and dirt because it was cold after all. There was a glacier right here. But now if you look next to it, there's plants. And so if there's plants there, there's all the things associated with plants, insects and vertebrates and things. So biology is redistributing itself around the world with the current global change that's going on. And all we can do right now is kind of sit back and watch and say, well, isn't that interesting? We don't know where it's going or really what's happening. So if you look in the headlines, last night I did a Google search for global warming and insects. This is the kind of thing that you generally hear about with the terms to climate change and insects, that you know the insects are going to take over the world because everything is getting hotter. But as was just pointed out in the first talk, it's really not that simple. Most likely, exactly the insects that we don't want to get more are going to get more, and everybody else is going to be hurting. But so, for example, there's these data sets from the British Isles that show that insects are under insect assemblages are under a lot of pressure. Whether or not this is due to climate change or not, it's hard to tell, but it probably is closely connected to that and kind of the other biggies of habitat destruction and these kind of things. So the name of this talk was in some sense a misnomer. So it's not just climate change that's the problem. It's global change in general. I'm a global change biologist. And in global change biology, global warming or climate change is just one little aspect of the whole business. So land cover changes, biological invasions, altered biogeochemical cycling, all of these things are now part of global change biology in general. And in particular, you could just say that climate change is just one little subset of altered biogeochemical cycling. There's lots of things going on with changing the carbon cycle. The atmospheric composition is changing. That's changing the composition of plants, which is changing nutritional supplies of food. The chemistry of the oceans are changing. A number of different things are changing because of these changes in the carbon cycle, not just climate change. So I want to look at some of these other aspects for a minute, just because they're kind of less considered than temperature, and we'll come back to temperature in a little bit. But as CO2 in the atmosphere goes up, plants change the chemical composition of their bodies. And the reason for this is that plants have two mouths, really. You have one mouth. You have one mouth where you take in carbon and the same mouth you take in nitrogen, the kind of the two biggies that you need to survive. But plants have two mouths, one for carbon, one for nitrogen. So we're shoving more carbon down their carbon mouth, and we're not giving them necessarily more nitrogen in their nitrogen mouth. So what's happening, it's the equivalent of saying you going to McDonald's and getting a Big Mac, say, and you have a certain amount of carbon to nitrogen when you eat that thing. But if McDonald's were to take that same amount of meat and shove it inside of an entire loaf of bread, you'd have to be eating a lot more carbon to get that protein requirement. So you can see here, as CO2 goes up, photosynthesis in plants pretty much universally goes up, which increases plant growth, but you're not necessarily getting more nitrogen, so it's changing the carbon to nitrogen ratio. So if for an insect that's interested in nitrogen, this is lowering the food quality of the plant. Carbohydrates are going up. Now, if you're interested in carbohydrates, like say an adult insect that's interested in powering its flight muscles, that's a good thing, so that's raising the food nutritional value of the plant. The allelochemical compositions of the plants are changing up and down in complicated ways, which may be good or may be bad depending on which allelochemical is the one that's of interest to the particular one that's eating it. So the bottom line is lots of things are changing and it's hard to tell. So how do you study these things? Well, you know, we have lots of the kind of the insect in the growth chamber kind of experiments. But now we have a new technology which allows us to look at entire insect assemblages all at once. And this new technology is called FACE. Free air carbon dioxide enrichment is what that acronym used to mean. And now it means free air concentration enrichment, because it dawned on them that they could do more than just carbon dioxide. They could kind of enrich in all number of gases. This is the soy face site at the University of Illinois. You can see that there's this ring of pipes kind of embedded in a soybean field. There's no dome, there's no walls or anything. And these pipes pump out, depending on the particular face site, either pure CO2 or CO2 enriched air. And the whole thing's under computer control to keep the amount of CO2 in the middle of that ring kind of constant. So we can enrich areas in elevated CO2. And what we did at this particular experiment is raise atmospheric CO2 in this site to what CO2 would be in the general atmosphere for about the year 2050. So not that far into the future, about 40 years only at this point. So what happens? We sampled insects in these things as well as herbivory and a number of other aspects. This chart here is showing the effects of the insect community. So the light blue bars are the ambient control rings, the green bars are elevated CO2 rings, and the yellow bars are elevated ozone rings. So you can see in terms of total number of insects, there's a greatly increased number of insects in the elevated CO2 rings. And if you go then and look at these insect assemblages and see what it is that's doing this, as it turns out, it's primarily, in this case, Japanese beetles. And so what we have in this particular experiment is an interaction between a global change, factor of altered atmospheric composition and another global change factor, which is invasive species. As you figure, Japanese beetles probably aren't native to Illinois, and they're not. So this fellow, Japanese beetle, in fact, decides that these things are really tasty. If you look and see what they're doing in there, they're certainly eating more. This is now an experiment of taking Japanese beetles and putting them into a container with tissue that was grown in either ambient or elevated CO2. And the Japanese beetles, sure enough, they can tell what they're eating. They're not just accidentally happening upon these areas in the field, when they have a choice, they go for the elevated CO2 grown foliage. And whether you measure on a dry weight or a wet weight basis, they eat more. And in fact, they do better when they eat the elevated CO2 foliage. This on your left is eggs laid per female. On the right is male longevity. And when you feed them the CO2, the elevated CO2 grown foliage, the females lay more eggs and the males live longer. So they're going there kind of on purpose. They're eating more and they're doing better. And so from the point of view of a Japanese beetle, this is what the soybean field looks like under elevated CO2, which is kind of Twinkies to the moon. Now, in this particular case, whether you're interested in kind of the plant perspective, which is that there's significantly more tissue being lost to pests, or you're interested in the insect perspective, which is the Japanese beetles are moving in, the question is this a universal conclusion that elevated CO2 raises the numbers of insects or increases herbivory in ecosystems? So we did the same sort of experiment in a forest instead of in a soybean field. So the technology is basically the same. It's just way, way more expensive when you do it in the forest. So it's the same thing with rings and pipes pumping out. So we're basically just irrigating with high CO2 air rather than irrigating with water. This is the Duke Face site near Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And so in this particular case, we got no increases in herbivory in elevated CO2 and no increases in overall numbers of insects. However, when we break it down into, in this particular slide, insect orders, there actually are all kinds of changes going on. The blue bars are showing insect orders which were increased under elevated CO2. The blue bars are the significant ones. The ones on the right side are the ones that are increased under elevated CO2. The ones on the left side are the ones that are increased under ambient CO2. So under elevated CO2, there's more spiders and there's more bees and wasps. Under ambient CO2, there's more mites, butterflies.